And welcome to Pods Like Us. I'm Martin Crabell, known to my friends as Marv, and this time I'm speaking with Matthew Anderson about the podcast he makes called Lone Screenplay Nominee. Hey, Matt, thanks for speaking with me today.
Hey, what's up? Glad to be on another podcast show, and always happy to be a guest. Whenever I show up on one of these. Sorry.
So I'm trying to work out, so Lone Screenplay Nominee. So are these films, because I've listened to a few episodes, are these films that have been nominated for screenplay and that's the only thing that they've been nominated for in awards?
Yeah, I thought about trying to come up with a better name for the podcast because I was trying to think of what's a better like title for it. But I'm like, the only one that comes across that could tell you what it is within the title is the Lone Screenplay Nominee Podcast, in which, yeah, you're right. Like it's just me covering with various guests on each episode. I try to do it like a bi-weekly show just because it gives me a little bit of time to find said movie and then do my research for the stuff that we'll get in. I'll explain a bit more later on in the show. But essentially, each movie that was nominated solely for an Academy Award in the writing category. So, for example, this upcoming Oscars, which I don't know when this episode will drop, but the Oscars that we're about to get, the 96th Oscars, the only lone screenplay nominee episode I'll be covering for this year is May December, which got a lone screenplay nomination, and that's it. And yeah, so I already have a guest hired for that, but there's a couple of episodes that were already scheduled, or at least I have guests interested in doing, but I won't mention exactly who they are yet because some of them will be done later this year. And I am actually going to be bringing back more guests on the podcast to talk about said films. One of the films that I will be doing is Glass Onion, which I have a feeling actually might be one of the more fun episodes we're doing just because of the guest I'm bringing on for that one. But yeah, that's pretty much it. It's just within the title, Lone Screenplay Nominee.
Yeah, because I mean, it's surprising, really, some of these films. I mean, I think you mentioned in the When Harry Met Sally episode, for instance, I think yourself and your guest, Christina.
Yeah.
I think you both mentioned that you were surprised about the fact that there were no nominations, I don't think, for Best Film or for either of the two mains for starring roles.
Yeah, and the thing about that is watching the movie and even seeing what the year they had nominated for Best Picture, because they went for Driving Miss Daisy, Born on the 4th of July, they went for Field of Dreams, My Left Foot, and then there was another one they went with. I can't remember on the top of my head what it was, but they don't usually go for dramas, especially in a year of five for Best Picture nominees. I mean, I bet you $10 this year with this upcoming Oscars, if we had like a sliding scale for Best Picture, meaning like if the nominees were like 8 or 9 Best Picture nominees, I actually think that Past Lives would have easily gotten the boot from Best Picture just because that's a film that's like it was very inconsistent where all throughout the guilds, and much like Harry Met Sally, it did do well enough of the Golden Globes, but it was very much like Past Lives was like a critic's darling, but there was enough passion just enough to get in for the straight 10. And I think When Harry Met Sally could have done it too, along with Do the Right Thing. But like I said, they're not like When Harry Met Sally is a comedy, and the Academy, especially back then, they're just not the biggest fans of it. And it was kind of a populist pick, so to speak, because it was a moneymaker. And Rob Reiner is always known for making populist movies, even A Few Good Men, which is a really good movie. But the point of that movie was to make money first and nothing more. I mean, there's been some like really ridiculous situations where a film that I thought would get in for Best Picture or even something like Best Director would have happened, and they just didn't. Like A Star Is Born, I thought was going to get in for director because Bradley Cooper was going to get all the, he got all those precursor nominations, and he just got booted out for, it was Paulo Kowalski for Cold War. Another one I just rewatched was Dune Part One, which I really thought Denis Villeneuve was going to get in for Dune. But looking back and seeing how the director's branches sort of expanded into more international directors, they were just never going to go for Dune, because even though it does have a bit of an artistic flair to it, it is a populist moneymaker. And I don't know why a lot of us were surprised that Greta Gerwig got snubbed for Barbie for director, because that is a moneymaker first, mess second. And believe me, Greta Gerwig did a really good job with the movie, but I always had a feeling ever since I saw Barbie, I was like, they just don't go for this kind of movie. So, but yeah, so I'm kind of jumping around a bit here with that. But yeah, When Harry Met Sally was a bit of a surprise, but at the same time, it makes sense as to why it just became a lone screenplay nominee.
Yeah. The problem is that even to this day, you'll find that a lot of Oscar contenders or nominees for best film or for actor or for actress it's unlikely that it's going to be a comedy.
Yeah.
To be honest, because there just seems to be something against comedy, even though in a case like When Harry Met Sally and some others, there's some really incredible bits of drama thrown there in as well. But it's because of the comedy element being first and foremost, Billy Crystal for starters, they'll look at the Billy Crystal thing and they'll go, right, he's a comedian, SNL, soap, all this precursor. There's no way that he's going to get to the, this is going to be our sort of thing. We'll give it the screenwriting, but because it's seen as a comedy, it's almost like an automatic no, we can't put that one in.
Well, and even looking at the lead actor field that they had that year, they had Daniel Day-Lewis for My Left Foot, Kenneth Branagh, Henry V, Tom Cruise, Born on the 4th of July, Morgan Freeman, and Robin Williams. They're all in dramatic roles, except for like maybe Robin Williams and Morgan Freeman, which I think their films are labeled as like comedy musical at the Globes. But there is somewhat of a message behind them that speaks to Academy voters as well. Another genre that I feel gets the short end of the stick, unfortunately, most years is horror films. Like The Exorcist was such a big phenomenon, icon of the genre or staple of it, and shows, hey, you could actually allow horror films to get in. I think Get Out might have been the last horror movie, but then again, it was more psychological horror like Black Swan was. And I remember 10 years ago over 10 years, I should say, my stepdad was really pissed that The Conjuring didn't get in for Best Picture because he loved that film so much. And he thought that was a great horror movie. And looking back, I'm like, yeah, they were just never going to go for that kind of movie. Yes, it's a somewhat of a biopic. It's based on real life people. But that kind of horror is something that older Academy voters would just be like, ew, let's not go near. The one horror film that I wanted to see get some kind of recognition or get some kind of Oscar shortlist, which they always do the last couple of years, where they announce, here's the films contending for the Oscars, like the top 10 categories, makeup and sound. And I would have loved to have seen Evil Dead Rise get in for makeup and sound, because the sound work they did a really impressive job with. Yep. And the makeup work is phenomenal, especially for the practical gore effects. And yet the Academy is like, nope, not for us. And I'm like, fucking typical. Yeah. Oh, sorry. but yeah, no, it's just so typical of them to do that and to sort of like shrug it off unless there's like a social message behind it, which is a shame. Because like I said, it's like every year it's like we want you guys to broaden your horizons and open your windows. I am grateful, though, that we are opening up to more international voters and we get more art house independent films, like Past Lives getting in for picture this past year was great.
Yep.
Zone of Interest getting in was awesome.
Parasite.
Even something like Parasite. Drive My Car is another one that it's. I think that was because of the critical push it got from the major trifecta awards that it's, and it sort of generated this buzz of Drive My Car. I don't know what this 3-hour art house film is. Let's check it out. And then it got in for 4 Oscar nominations, which is great.
Hi, this is Zach from Belated Binge Harry Potter. and you're listening to Pods Like Us.
I'm Agent Scott.
And I'm Cam the Provocateur.
And we're from the Spy Hards podcast.
That's right, and you are listening to Pods Like Us, the podcast that also has the Midas touch.
Number one, speaking my language when you talk practical with effects and makeup and things like that. I will always go that way. More most of the time, I will go towards that sort of thing when it comes to films. I sometimes think that the CGI is overblown nowadays, and in some ways, I like in camera actual effects essentially, because it, I don't know, it probably makes it easier in the post as well. I would have thought post. If you're talking films that popularity, I mean, when you were speaking with your was he your professor about Crocodile Dundee? I mean, the ratio there, how much it cost to make and how much it made at the cinema, is absolutely staggering.
Yeah, it's shocking that it for a budget like that, it was like under 10, like 8.8 million or maybe like 10 million. And yeah, it made like 300 million worldwide. Where nowadays it's like Indiana Jones, the Dial of Destiny was budgeted $300 million and it couldn't even break even. And I just like, and a lot of it is because of obviously like inflation and such, but you just don't need that much money, especially when it doesn't even look that, I don't know. This whole idea now of like studios deciding to throw a bunch of money at these bigger intellectual properties, but they're not even going to bother making it look good or impressive. Like at least with Star Wars, The Force Awakens, yeah, there's a lot of CG effects, but there's also a lot of practical effects in it too. And because they had to combine both of those, the budget on that was inflated to like maybe $400 million for the budget, but it was going to be a hit. Like, it's just a matter of how big the hit was going to be. But even looking at something like Ex Machina, which was like, I don't even know what the budget of that was on the top of my head. I'll see if I could look it up on my computer here. But $15 million was the budget for Ex Machina. And you see the effects work involved on that. And it's so staggering. It's like, how did they do this? It's quite impressive. Even Godzilla was another one where they said they made it for a very much smaller budget than expected. Godzilla Minus One, I should say.
Yep.
And look at the effects for that. It's those effects houses are doing a better job, but they only had to work with 30, 35 people, including the director himself. And the effects look as good as they do. That's pretty impressive. So I don't understand why so many of these studios keep imploding these budgets and they think, oh, if we implode them, that means we're going to make a budget back. And it's, no, you're not. Because even the Marvels flopped. Aquaman 2 barely made money. And I think the only one that really had an inflated budget, but it actually so far is making a profit, is Dune Part 2, which just came out. That's the only one I can think of that made any kind of like real money. But you're right, though. Yeah, Crocodile Dundee is $8 million and did as well as it did. And a lot of it was just because I assume it was just like an independent production. Like the way they shot it, because it, and again, inflation, because back then in the 80s, it wasn't as costly as it is now to make a movie in certain states. And you also have these, what was it, tax, not write off, but like tax refund or tax credits for your film. If you work in a certain state like California does, or New York City, I believe it does. But yeah, it's very fascinating.
Yeah. You film in London and it costs you an absolute fortune.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah. And yeah. And even there was a movie with Tom Cruise was in it. It was Vanilla Sky, I think it was, where they were able to pay off New York City officials and say, can you at least give us like 1 hour to film in Times Square? And it cost them like a lot of money to do that. And yet it paid off for them, I guess. But yeah.
That is a good looking scene as well when they get that on in the film Vanilla Sky. When you see that sequence there, where it's a strange thing to see, and I think that's the sort of thing that he was after getting, the sort of idea, because when you've got Tom Cruise there in character and it's Times Square, and it's completely void of anybody, no traffic, no people, and it's just him there. Mm-hmm. It does give that sort of, it's almost, but not quite to the same degree, but almost like the sequence in the original, spoiler here for a film that's over 50 years old, but it's almost like that sequence at the end of Planet of the Apes with the Statue of Liberty. It's got that almost that sort of feel to it.
Yeah. And to jump back to what you were saying, though, about the model work and using a lot of practical effects, one franchise that still holds up to this day for like special effects work and how they combined practical elements with CG was Lord of the Rings. That is like easily some of the best work I've seen. And it's shocking that a movie like that, 20 years old, or more than 20 years, at least for that franchise, still holds up. Meanwhile, when you look at the Hobbit movies, it's like mostly computer generated and it's like doesn't nearly hold as much weight as the effects work in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And that's because, well, also they had this whole lack of prep for the Hobbit movies, where the Lord of the Rings movies, they prepped for 3 or 4 years before they started shooting those three films. So.
The Hobbit, all I can think of with the Hobbit is, because I think I've only seen the first part of that. Hmm. And what I thought when it was leading up to it, and they're saying, oh, it's part one of three, all I could think of was, that's a book that I read in one sitting. How on earth can they make a book that I can read in one sitting last for three films? But they've just bolstered it with all sorts of other extra bits and pieces in there, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just the whole studio wanting to make more money and squeeze every dime of it out of it. It always is with this stuff. But anyways.
They could have easily have just said to him, oh, just make one film about The Hobbit, which it deserves, and then do a film about one of the other books. And they could have just come out with films about the different books, really.
Yeah.
To be honest. So anyway, we've already done all this, and we haven't even gone into the points that I've got up there on my list.
No, exactly. Great. Yeah.
So, have you actually got a favorite memory of film?
Oh boy, there's like tons of memories from film I can remember. There's been a lot of memories of film. I remember seeing Return of the King in theaters. That was great. I loved seeing. Seeing Furious 7 like opening weekend or opening night? That was awesome. But that's a whole other story I could go on about. But it might be a bit too long for this podcast.
The last good Fast and Furious film.
I will agree. That's probably like where the franchise should have ended. But at the same time, I don't hate the other ones except for maybe Hobbs and Shaw. Like the other ones I find tolerable, like more so than some other franchises that have gone downhill. But I do agree. Yeah, Fast 7 is like the last great one they had. And then one of my favorite memories, for me at least, was taking my drive down to, actually it was pretty recently, like November or December of last year, seeing Maestro in New York City. It was like one of the first times I had seen a Netflix film on the big screen, and I actually went out of my way to see it. Because usually when Netflix does, they do these whole like limited releases, and then they're like, oh, we'll send it to Netflix streaming services in a month or so. Like All Quiet on the Western Front, Irishman, Marriage Story. I'm like, yeah, all right, I could wait for those. But Maestro was like, no, I actually want to see this on the big screen. And that was, the sound work for that was incredible, especially with the El Cathedral sequence where Cooper is conducting the Mahler Symphony Orchestra set piece. Like that was phenomenal. Like the choir, it was like the sound mix was incredible. And yeah, and I was able, I spent a whole day driving to New York City with my uncle and then driving back. And we were just talking about the movie and we were just like, yeah, that was a really good movie, especially with the makeup work for that was incredible. And to the point where even my uncle was like, he couldn't even find one flaw with the makeup work. Even when he has the older makeup work with the wrinkles around the neck, it's really impressive. And then you see some of the work that's done through behind the scenes videos with what Kazuhiro did and his team did. And I'm like, damn, they really did a hell of a job doing that work. But yeah, there's tons of memories. But I guess if I had to pick just one, I guess that would be the memory I'd pick, I guess.
Hi. I'm Bob Jeffy from the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. You're listening to Pods Like Us. By the way, Do you know where whales and dolphins get their news? From podcasts. Bye for now.
Hey, this is Jeff Cummings from the Best Song Podcast, the show that is telling the stories of every song nominated for the Academy Award. You're listening to Pods Like Us.
Yep, and only now have I realized that I missed a point from earlier on where, just very quickly to touch on the, you're going on about the effects with Lord of the Rings. You're right, that's a really good marriage of the practical and the CG together, where I think that's the issue. I think that's a good thing where you can do that, and you can, it's almost like taking what they've done with the practical and it just touching up on it a bit with the CG and making it a bit better, as opposed to making it completely one, completely CG. That, so I think you're right about the effects for that. Where else was I going to go there? But something that you've pointed out, you mentioned there with what you just said, you're on about a film that you saw at the cinema that was a Netflix film. It makes me think of, I mean, I don't know what you think of it, and don't know what many people think of it, but we saw the Fletch film with John Hamm in it. John Hamm is in a film about that's based on the Fletch series. Exactly.
Yeah, this is the first time I've ever hearing of this.
Right. It was supposed to go to the cinemas, but it is where I'm going with this. I mean, we really enjoyed it. And it was one of those cases where it was a film, it's called Confess Fletch. And it's a case of one of those films that was virtually ready to go out when COVID hit, essentially, but didn't, because everywhere was closed down and lockdown happened. And then we had this thing, do you remember where we had this thing where it was, right, what are we going to do with these films? Oh, I know. These films that we've got all there that are films that are a bit arty and we might not make us a ton of money, we'll throw those onto streaming platforms. Yeah. And the films that we think are going to make enormous amounts of money, they're the ones that will rush out to the cinema because we've got all this backlog of film. And I think, in a sense, that's a bit of a worry. Well, to me personally, I see a thing where there's still this thing for films that I think are good films being left and put onto streaming platforms and not being given that cinema experience. And it's that happening now where you get that and you get these big blockbusters that are going straight into the cinemas, and some films are not going into the cinemas and being missed by people because they've not got that big promotion going behind them of them going into a cinema and having the trailers.
Well, and the point of Netflix is they want to make sure that these movies are on their viewable at home, not do like a whole theatrical release. Like, they have no interest in doing the whole money-making in theaters. Like, I know Glass Onion did, it actually would have been a box office hit if they had allowed it to stand for another month. But Netflix said, nope, we're only releasing it for 1 week. And even they thought, yeah, after our testing for this, it's like, we're not going to do this ever again. We're only going to have said movie show up at the Paris Theater in New York City, which is like a Netflix owned theater, or select cities in New York, LA and Chicago and such. But yeah, and then you also have the idea of these studios, just they're not interested in making these creative films that we typically have. If you did something like, I don't know, like Chinatown, like you can't do that nowadays. I mean, the subject matter involved aside, you can't really have a big studio like Universal or Paramount or Disney to be like, hey, can you give us like $30 million for this? And it almost seems like these people they're forgetting how to market mid-budget leveled films. And they decide, and maybe that's part of the reason why they're imploding the budgets, because we know how to market a 100 million budget film, 200, 300 million budget film. We know how to, but we don't know how to budget a mid-budget movie. It's the same thing as you do with any other film. Even the mid-2000s, we had a lot of those and they were like modest hits. But I guess a modest hit for studios is like a curse, or an omen, so to speak. It's, yeah, cut this. We don't like it. So,
well, I mean, you look at films from the past that have done really well. I mean, going back to the Oscars, as well, films that have done really well. If they were still using that same ideal, that these film studios were using that, and film companies were using that, back then, some films that are really good and really popular and Oscar winners as well, Hello, Godfather, Taxi Driver, and a lot of these films from back then, they would have been seen now as, oh, put them straight to streaming because there's no way that they're going to make that. And it's that whole idea of that. I mean, I think they're perfect examples of films where it would be like that. I mean, look at The Irishman. That went straight to streaming. But if that film had come out, if Scorsese had done that film 30 years ago, that would have been an Oscar contender that had been in the cinemas for a few months, not straight to streaming.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I could see that. The other thing I do worry about is that I'm pretty sure Once Upon a Time in America was like, I know they condensed the movie down to 2 hours and 20 minutes, but I think that was a box office flop. And then they tried releasing it again with an extended cut. And it's, that's didn't get much awards attraction. But yeah, Scorsese is always, he's an interesting figure to cover and talk about with the Oscars, especially when he's only won one Oscar. And sorry to say, he's not going to win for Killers of the Flower Moon for picture director, just because the one time they gave him the Oscar, it's the time when he had no competition. And it was almost like where Nolan is right now, where if you have no competition, we can't really pick someone else here, even though some of the voters may not want to give it to Nolan or Scorsese in his case, and be like, screw it, let's give it to Scorsese because why not? But yeah, yet like he has other films of his who've won Oscars, like The Aviator, Hugo, and Goodfellas and Color Money, which some of them have been box office hits, although Hugo was a bomb.
It's a shame. But, I like Hugo.
Yeah, I'll bring that up in one of my discussions later on, according to your little chart that you have there, some of the points you want to bring up, because I think I found we'll talk about it in a minute. But yeah.
Yep. Once Upon a Time in America, by the way, I thought that was Sergio Leone.
No, that was, well, it was, but like I'm saying a movie like Once Upon a Time in America. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Yeah, that didn't mean to confuse you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a superb film. I mean, the cinematography, it's Sergio Leone. Of course he's going to get great cinematography.
Yeah, that's one of my, it's definitely on my to-do list. Like a lot of long movies like that, I sort of have to spend a weekend to watch or just spend like a long day. I just got Ben-Hur on Blu-ray a couple days ago. I've never seen Ben-Hur. I've never seen it all the way through or at any of it at all. And so I'm going to try to spend maybe over the summertime, I'll try to spend a day where I'll be watching that all the way in one go. I still want to revisit Lawrence of Arabia because I got that on 4K Blu-ray a while back. And I just recently saw it right as I went to Stevenson University, which was fun.
Hot take there from me. People need to watch more films made by David Lean, because I think he started to not be watched as much as he used to be.
Even better hot take. Everyone should actually start watching older movies. Because a lot of, I'm sorry to say this, guys, I like Dune Part 2, but to say it's like one of the greatest films of all time, or to say suck it, Lawrence Arabia or Citizen Kane, sit down. That's, you realize the films that, like, the creative films that we're getting now and the ones that are really good were inspired in some way, shape, or form by older movies. Like Denis Villeneuve, I don't know what his inspiration is, but Christopher Nolan, he's inspired by a lot of old cinema. Same with Martin Scorsese. He's inspired by Sergio Leone for a couple things, I believe. It's like all these great directors that we have now, even Greta Gerwig is another director who's inspired by older cinema from the 70s, 80s, and stuff like Truman Show, like when she did Barbie. But it's
2001 at the beginning of Barbie.
Yeah, exactly. It's so like everyone just watch, just seriously, go onto your streaming service, go to like your local movie store, whatever, and just watch more older movies. Seriously, there's so much great cinema out there. Not just that, but even in the international market itself, it's, I wouldn't even discovered Old Boy if I hadn't decided to watch like subtitled films, or like Lady Snowblood, which is actually quite good. I've only seen the first part though. And like Seven, like Kieran Kurosawa is another filmmaker.
Yeah.
All together. Look at the stuff that he did.
By Kurosawa, Hidden Fortress is a great film that people don't realize. I mean, is the other films that people do mention, like Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, they are great films, but that's a case where people will name a couple of films by filmmaker and then not look at the rest of what's going on in there. But since we're going on a shout out,
yeah,
you people need to really look at filmmakers such as Hitchcock, one of the greatest film directors of all time.
Yep.
John Ford, greatest westerns of all time. So Hitchcock, John Ford, and I'm actually going to say Sergio Leone as well.
Yeah, I still need to see more of his stuff. Same with Hitchcock. And so far, Hitchcock, I've only seen like 4 movies. The lowest I've ever given a Hitchcock movie was an 8 out of 10. And even then, that's still pretty good.
What got the 8?
I know on the top of my head, it was Psycho, Rear Window, and Rebecca. Rebecca is really good. Oh my God. Yeah. But I would say my favorite of his so far that I've seen is Rope. That to me is my favorite of his. And that was the first one I saw of his work. And I'm watching that. I saw that in film class at Stevenson University. And I was like, man, no wonder why so many people were. I mean, again, all these old movies that I'm bringing up and I'm like, I haven't seen like Sergio Leone, Akira Kurosawa.
That's a 3-shot film.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like in Rope. And again, Hitchcock is another director where it's, I will get around to him. In fact, I even have, I can't show you two on camera, but behind me, I have a whole shelf of movies, old and new, that I have. And I have another deck all the way in another room for the entertainment room. There's like a whole slew of films. And one of them includes like this big box set I had when I was on the 1-Inch Barrier podcast. We were covering War and Peace from the 60s. If you haven't seen it yet, you got to watch that, guys, because that's awesome. But I had the whole box set of the Ingmar Bergman films. I have all of them. Yeah. At least the one that came in the Criterion. But yeah, so yeah. But at this point, yeah, we're just rattling off stuff and we're not even talking about my podcast.
No.
Hey, it's Rena, host of the Better Call Daddy show, where I interview guests, share the stories with my dad, and then he weighs in. And you're listening to Pods Like Us.
Hello, Scoob believers. This is DJ Scoob. From The Undiscovered Entrepreneur, a show that highlights brand new entrepreneurs that are just getting started in their entrepreneur adventure. And you're listening to Pods Like Us with my good friend Marv. Thank you.
So what would you say is your... I'm going to ask one of your own questions of you now.
Yeah, sure.
So what is your favorite film genre?
I'm glad you asked this because I thought to myself when I created the show, I'm like, it's really hard to come up with a favorite movie. Why don't I just come up with a favorite genre? What's your favorite genre? And now I'm like, oh, okay. Now I'm in the hot seat. And I'm like, it's kind of tough. I guess dramas, just to be basic. I really love a really good drama and just really solid work you can get. And we already mentioned some of the greats, John Ford, and even Steven Spielberg is one who's created some great dramatic work. Yeah, but no, a really good drama engages me personally when I watch a film. But I do try to broaden my horizons a bit. I'm trying to dabble more into horror films, although much like romantic comedies, it's for every good film you get in the horror genre, you always have to go through 10 crappy ones. So yeah, but no, drama would be the one at my go-to. It's okay, sure.
So what was your inspiration then to start this show about screenplays? And yeah.
So I didn't even mention right off the top, I received my bachelor's degree in film and moving image in the writing producing track at Stevenson University, which is a private institution. And that's where I found some of my guests on there, Professor Ernst and Stacy Gensler, who was on the Margin Call episode. She was one of my teachers there. In fact, I managed to get her on board for Margin Call because she worked on the movie. And that was the only way I was willing to do that episode in of itself because of her. And I was like, all right. So anyways, but yeah, so I got a writing degree there in film and moving image. And I for it. And also, too, I'm an Oscar predictor. Like, I admittedly, I do kind of do it a bit cynically and do it just because I kind of want to get the ego side of me is I want to get all the predictions right. Because I think the closest I ever got with Oscar predictions was the year that Coda won Best Picture, where I got every category right except two. And that was it. I only missed two categories. And that was the end of the entire ceremony. Granted, it was a little bit boring outside of how terrible the show was and that incident that happened. But yeah, I was able to get everything right. But yeah, so I'm an Oscar predictor and I was going through the history and I'm like, yeah, it's really interesting how many lone screenplay nominees we have and films that just get a screenplay nod and nothing else. And sometimes you get a film that's generating buzz. May, December for a little bit was like kind of generating buzz for potential awards play for outside of screenplay until the Screen Actors Guild said, we are not nominating this. And therefore, your chances of getting in for Best Picture or any of these other categories are pretty low. And even the BAFTA just kind of took a big whiff and just was like, nope, get out of here. But really the one movie for me that was just like, screw it, I'm pressing the button on this and I'm going to start doing my research on it, on creating the show and such, was Glass Onion.
Yeah,
Glass Onion was the movie that I had seen in December when that came out. It feels like forever now. And I'd watched that movie and I'm like, yeah, it's a really fun movie. I'm engaged with it. I'm enjoying it. And God, I would have loved to have seen that with the crowd, honestly, especially with some of those twists and turns. But that film is really fun to watch. And I was watching clips of it again and I'm like, I really do need to sort of cover this a bit of like why this only got a screenplay nomination. And I think that Knives Out franchise might be like the one of the few franchises where a previous movie and its sequel got a lone screenplay nomination at the Oscars. The only one I could think of was the Before movies, like Before Sunset, I believe, and then Before Midnight.
Yeah.
But with the case of Rian Johnson, he managed to get in for original and adapted screenplay, in which he is like a slew of writers who managed to get in both categories. Christopher Nolan joined the ranks this year, Tony McNamara, Noah Baumbach, and Bradley Cooper. I thought that was interesting. And like I said, it was enough for me to go, I want to push the button on this. And I started gaining some of my colleagues, some of which from Awards Radar podcast, Miles Hughes and Joey Magnuson. I'll get into Joey Magnuson in a minute, but I managed to call upon Miles to say, I'm thinking about doing this podcast. Do you want to come on board and do the Knives Out episode? And he said, sure, yeah. And we had a really fun time. And it was fascinating with how the episode turned out. And and ever since then, I've been really grateful, even if some of them have been, maybe one or two of them have been kind of a slog to get through the movie. But outside of that, it's a really fun show I've created.
You've just made me think that I've answered one of your questions in my blog, by the way, that's not come out yet. You asked in one of your episodes, or you and your guests were talking about Noah and Greta, and they are actually married, from I've heard it mentioned in other shows before now. Because it was mentioned in your show, you weren't sure whether or not they were.
Yeah, I think it was, I can't remember when we talked about Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig on the show, but I know recently they just
20th Century Women when you mentioned that one.
Yeah, they might have gotten married right after that episode aired, because I'm looking through. Yeah, they said they got married December 2023. Okay. So they like just got married this past December. And we recorded that episode in like August or September.
All right.
It might have been around the time when Annette Bening's other movie, Naiad, was coming out and at the festivals. And we're like, all right, let's record it. So, yeah.
But I was going to go somewhere else then. Oh, where was I going to go? There. Oh. Yeah, we enjoyed Knives Out and Glass Onion as well. The Menu was an interesting film.
Yeah, the menu is an interesting movie because it was like a mild hit at the box office. Like, it made enough money last time I checked, but yet it wasn't really the kind of movie to get awards necessarily. Yeah, it was just, yeah, I guess it was, and also too, like, of the films that were like treating of the high society, higher class with their wealth and such, or being a satire of it, it just wasn't the one that was going to do it for Academy voters, because they already had Triangle of Sadness and Glass Onion. And yeah, Menu only got in for a couple Golden Globe nods and like a Writers Guild nomination. And I think it got some critics groups mentions. But yeah, it just wasn't the kind of movie. And also Searchlight had other focus elsewhere. They were trying to get Banshees of Inisherin an Oscar, but it went home empty handed. And yeah, it just, yeah.
I mentioned that because I knew that was the same year as, was it Glass Onion, the same year as that? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that and Triangle of Sadness, yeah. It was the year of like the rich, yeah.
And that allowed me the time to remember what I was going to talk about. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot with this one because you're not expecting this. So just to time this, we are both speaking on the 5th of March. And this episode will be going out the second week of April. So Matt's going to hate this one. Right. The Oscars are this to us now, this coming weekend on the 10th of March. So now I'm going to say to Matt, what do you think yourself is going to win Oscar for movie, best actress, and best actor?
You immediately dated the episode.
And possibly screenplay. Actually, screenplay would probably be a better question.
Well, I could tell you for screenplay, well, original screenplay, do you want me to just answer the screenplay question or?
Yeah, go on then. Go on. Okay. Screenplay. Yeah.
The screenplay. Well, I know original category, the original screenplay category is probably going to be Anatomy of a Fall. It's the one that's been generating a lot of buzz. And the moment it won the Golden Globe Prize, I'm like, yeah, it's over. It even won international film over the film that got submitted for the Oscars, The Zone of Interest. And then, so yeah, Anatomy of a Fall, I think, is just going to win original screenplay. Adapted screenplay right now, I still think it's going to be American Fiction. But I mean, I have been hearing rumblings with people who've talked with Academy voters that said there's a chance that Oppenheimer could pull an upset just because of how strong that movie is at the Oscars, which will win Best Picture. But American Fiction, just it if it does win the Oscar for adapted screenplay, it's always felt to me like the type of movie that they would go for. It won the TIFF Audience Prize, the Toronto International Film Festival Prize, which is like their audience award they give out, and it's won a handful of prizes at all these like festivals like Middleburg and a couple other stuff. And yeah, I've been hearing a lot of rumblings that American Fiction also has its own like major support from the voters as well, because their American Fiction can only win one Oscar and it's adapted screenplay. Like Oppenheimer has other chances to win, including director. Killian's probably going to win the Oscar and Downey Jr. is probably going to win the award. Although by the time this episode comes out, we'll see if I'm right or wrong. But yeah.
So that was actually going to be my next one, was, do you think that with all the talk about Downey that he will actually get supporting?
Yep. Yeah. There's no challenger like the Best Picture and Director. There has been no challenger in the televised awards. And if there was one, it would have happened already. And voting's already done at this point. As we're recording, he's won everything he needs to with Golden Globes, Critics' Choice, SAG, and BAFTA. And usually when you win those kind of trophies, you tend to go on to win the Oscar. The only case I could think of on the top of my head that didn't happen was Russell Crowe for A Beautiful Mind, but that's only because he threw a phone backstage at the BAFTAs after he won for A Beautiful Mind and put one of the producers of the show and like up against the wall and threatened him after cutting his speech. I think he was giving like some sort of like tribute to Richard Harris or someone. And that happened during Oscar voting. And I assume a lot of voters were like, okay, we are not giving you another Oscar. And that's why that's probably why Denzel Washington won his second Oscar. That's my theory, at least.
Yeah. Warning to people, do not piss off Russell Crowe.
Yeah, please don't. Yeah.
And we need Russell.
Yeah, and also too, if you're trying to get an Oscar, don't put these pouty, moody, pissy moods especially during Oscar voting. You want to be a nice boy or a nice girl or person, especially because I know I don't know what has been going on this whole season. I get it. Cooper made a couple of weird comments over the last couple of weeks on the news, but it was so strange since November, December that all these people were like online. There was such a hatred towards Cooper for Maestro. And I just don't get it. Yeah, I get it. The guy's a bit weird with some of his comments he made. You could find it on the internet. I'm not even going to bother what they were, but it's so strange that everyone's going to put a target on Cooper, even though like he made a movie that he was very passionate about. And yes, it is Oscar baity, but only because it came out in the middle of awards season. And honestly, I do think Cooper thought he was going to win the Oscar for this, but those chances were just dwindling really quickly once the televised awards came out. And yeah, I just don't get it. I really don't get why people were putting a target on Cooper when literally everyone does this every year where they do an Oscar baity movie. Some of them are trying so hard to get the Oscar and do all these campaign tactics. And yet we're going to target Cooper when there's other more egregious campaigners. And like everyone says, unless you're not going to the show and say, screw this, I'm not going at all, like Albert Finney did. Everyone wants the Oscar. Everyone does. They're going to do whatever it takes to get that award. Even Glenn Close probably wanted that Oscar more than everyone thought. The wife was wanted. She wanted that so much. And she probably thought she was going to win it until Olivia Colman surprised that night, which was awesome. I will never forget that moment. But yeah, but like I said, it's just everyone wants the Oscar. So I don't understand why Cooper should be the one targeted this whole season when, again, there's other people who've been more aggressive towards this, but whatever.
What I'm going to pull out of that one is everybody loves Olivia Colman.
Yeah, she was, oh my God, that performance was great. And I love that speech. And I loved everything about that win. It was so great. I loved her shock.
This is Dan Yorgos from crying. 1 Minute Podcast.
I loved the show Emma Stone. That helps you be like, a better Emma podcaster Stone was in just more a minute excited that Olivia Colman won than Emma Stone was for winning her own Oscar for La La Land. And I loved everything about that speech that she gave. It was so great. But it was awesome.
Hey, this is Chris from Podtastic Audio, the show that I have created to help you create your amazing podcast. And you are listening to Pods Like Us.
Emma Stone makes me think that Andrew Garfield lost Best Actor Oscar for pretending that he wasn't in that Spider-Man film.
He was never going to win that year for Hacksaw Ridge. It was like the competition. It was always going to be Casey Affleck the whole year. And then even with the Will Smith year, it was so funny because when Will Smith was about to win the Oscar, it was funny too. Because that year in particular, I saw the trailer for King Richard. It was like literally one of two times I've called this in my entire life predicting the Oscars where I had seen, all I had to do was just watch the trailer for King Richard and say, yep, Will Smith's winning the Oscar. Didn't even need to wait for audience reactions. It's showing up at Telluride and all these festivals. And meanwhile, some of my buddies were like, no, Garfield's going to win this. I'm like, you sure about that? And as the season kept going and going, and they're like, oh, crap, Matt's right. Will Smith is about to win the Oscar. I'm like, yep. So, but yeah. And it would have been a great win if he didn't muck up his own moments that night. But everyone's already talked about that. We don't need to rip that Band-Aid again. So
no, anyways. we're not going there.
Nope.
But you've already touched on, we've touched on show history, topics and guests, the research you do. So recording and editing then.
So I record through, what was it called? It was Riverside. Yep. Excuse me. I record through Riverside, which is a pretty helpful and useful tool to use to record to record on. And then after that, when I'm done recording with the guests, I chat with them for a little bit, tell them how the show went and if they had any other questions. And sometimes like I have some of my guests who I talk for about a couple more minutes or maybe half an hour talking about the Oscars or whatever. Like, what movies are you seeing? What's going on and such? And then I edit using Audacity, which is a useful site, even a useful program, I should say, except it always bugs every so often. There's like a bug out for it every so often. And there's been times where I had to redo the entire thing a couple of times. I know the one I recorded for, it was like right as I was about to go to Hawaii, I had to re-edit the Another Year episode. And that was a pain to do because I'm like, oh my God, I got to leave tonight or tomorrow to go out of town. And then we got to wake up early in the morning. I'm like, I don't want to do this. So I was like, screw it. I woke up, I had 5 hours of sleep, and I was like, all right, I got a little bit of time, and I managed to get it done in an hour to edit the whole thing and get it pressed. And obviously I'm paying attention. Unless there have been a couple episodes where I'm like, even while we're recording, I don't need to pay too much attention to it when I'm editing it. Cause I'm like, all right, it's going smoothly enough. And I always have my earphones in, and every once in a while I'm like sort of checking my phone. But I'm still paying attention to the audio bit. But for the most part, it's like pretty useful stuff. And I'm glad I was able to do some of the editing classes at Stevenson as well, because that also helped me a little bit with getting the volume down, making sure the volume pitch, I think it is, isn't too high or in the red zone, because if it is, you don't want it peaking. So that was something I learned a lot about the editing stuff at school and sound work. And I've been using some of my techniques from my degree to create the podcast as well, which is great and always useful. So.
Okay. And now we're going to go what we were discussing before we started, the music and logo.
So the music I got through a royalty-free music site, and the two tracks I use, I'm going to pull up the names for it. I always credit the artist for it. So the one is just like a generic title, Inspiring Motivational Mood by Alex Makes Music. And the other one for my, I believe, outro is the Lo-Fi Roads for intro or outro. And I just wanted to create something that was, just something that kind of was a bit modern, but wasn't too tech-based kind of music. I didn't create it myself, but like I said, I just use royalty-free music, I swear. And then as for the logo itself, I believe I might have created it through Podcasters when I was creating the profile and the page for the first time on Podcasters through Spotify. And I came across the Oscar with the clapper. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. All right. So I'll do that. And I was like, Lone Screenplay Nominee Podcast. Let's see if I can fit it on there. I did. And I was like, boom, got it. So, yeah.
So it was really quick then. I mean, did it take a while for you to find the right tunes and to find the right logo? Or was it really that quick that you just sort of found them and you were like, yep, they're the ones?
Yeah. I don't try to overthink when it comes to the logo. It was so obvious to me the moment I saw that picture. It might have even taken me like 5 minutes at least, maybe like 10, 15 at most. But it wasn't really like a long process. But keep in mind, I had to create all of this stuff while I was in my research phase before I made it publicly known. I'm pretty sure I did allude to that I was thinking about creating a podcast for it, but I didn't mention what it was yet. I know I got a couple of direct messages from people being like, what's the podcast going to be about? What is it about? What is it? And I was like, hold your horses. Give me like a couple days or another week and I'll get back to you. And for the music stuff, it did take me about maybe again, like another 10, 15 minutes. It was just very much, okay, that works enough for the show. Might like when we get to our 1 year anniversary, I might change it up a bit, at least with the intro or outro. Maybe we'll see. But I kind of like the music cues that I'm using now, honestly.
Right. You've hinted at this earlier on. So your three film hot takes.
Yes. So I'm glad we mentioned one of them already right off the bat. Look, I love Martin Scorsese. I think he is a brilliant filmmaker and one that I consider a treasure. And I don't know why, but there were a couple of brats online who were criticizing Martin Scorsese films. It's don't want to see those. Get them out of here. Kills the Fireman was way too long. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, clearly. Thank you, film TikTok. I needed your opinion. It clearly shows that you're not willing to go watch old movies, or you've never been to film school and watch old art house movies like Agnes Varda. Okay, come on.
Yeah. Bring back Quibi.
Yeah. So it pains me to say this, but I am not the biggest fan of Hugo. I've seen it twice, and the second time I tried so hard to really admire or try to appreciate the movie more, but I just can't. And a lot of it is really because of I always have an issue, and I realize this too. It's not the actors, it's the directors that I have an issue with. It's when they're directing kid actors for major films and they're trying to direct them in major roles. There's a few kid actors out there who, when they transition into adulthood, they still suck. But it's clear to me that not every director is able to direct or give good, great kids performances from everyone who's the one. Lars von Trier apparently is one who's not really a great director when it comes to kids, or he doesn't really know how to direct them properly. Justine Triet did a fantastic job with Milo Machado Grainer. I think I might have butchered that name from Anatomy of the Fall. He was fantastic. And I don't know why he wasn't even in the awards conversation for supporting actor at all. I don't understand why he wasn't, outside of, oh, they hate kids.
De Niro did a great job of directing DiCaprio in A Boy's Life.
Oh, yeah. And DiCaprio ended up being like a really good actor. And it was because of that movie that De Niro sort of tapped Marty on the shoulder and said, I almost said Marty on the Scorsese, but Marty on the shoulder and say, hey, you might want to look into this DiCaprio kid. He's pretty good. And look at the career he's had with Wolf of Wall Street, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Revenant, The Departed. Like, he's so good. But yeah, it's just like Martin Scorsese is just one of the few directors that he's able to excel in dramas and create really captivating crime stories and do something like a period drama like Age of Innocence, which I think is an amazing, a really solid movie. But he can't direct kids. And it's very, even in Gangs in New York, it was very much, yeah, you're not that good of a director when it comes to kids, because you don't know how to direct them within said scenes. And And even with Hugo, though, it's just like the main focus is on this kid. There's not much depth to the kid. There's not really much there in the writing for me to care about the character himself. And really, the only two aspects of the movie that I did admire were I loved Ben Kingsley with that whole flashback. Yeah. That was amazing. Yeah. I wish that was the entire movie was on him. Because it's so devastating and it's so heartbreaking to see what he has to go through. But it's also amazing and it's imaginative, and I love that. And while it was a bit cliched, I did admittedly think the Sacha Baron Cohen subplot with the flower girl, it was a little bit cliched. I've seen this done before and a little bit better, but it was cute, it was nice. But not to that, I really didn't care much for the movie, and quite honestly, I was frankly bored watching it. And I'm flabbergasted that it got the technical Oscars it got, but I guess it was just one of those cases where it's film preservation, and it was just like the only big tech movie that they had at the Oscars. And I'm pretty sure that was another year, like many years it seems to be, where the Oscars decide to go for a more boring set of nominees and winners, when it's like there's so much better cinema out there. Steve McQueen's Shame should have gotten in for Oscar consideration for Michael Fassbender and like Carey Mulligan, who's really good in it. So that's one. Two. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to quickly say about the Hugo thing. I mean, you're right. The bits that stand out to me, and I mean, I've mentioned this on shows where I've spoken with people about film before, and the thing about Hugo that I really love are the, or my favorite bits are the flashbacks. When they go, and that is where you see Marty as the lover of film history.
Yeah.
Really big time. Because he's showing how those clips in these classic films, well, classic to us that love old films and the old film history, like Le Don's Voyage, Le Lune, or whatever, and those sort of things. And you see how these films were created and these special effects, they're the bits that jump out at me and make me, give me like the wow moment, essentially, is because he's showing you how it was done. And they're the more interesting bits to me than those bits in that time frame with the boy running around the train station, trying not to get caught by Sacha Baron Cohen and all this, that, and the other. And it's those bits with, like I said, Ben Kingsley's character and what he's going through and his film history that are the most important bits. In essence, he should have made a film about that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's they chose the wrong character to focus on, in my opinion. I'll try to make the other two brief. Yeah, but what was it? The second one I would say is, I understand this kind of gets a bit of a bad rap by many, but I actually don't mind Running Scared. It's a 2006 movie by Paul Walker. It was starring Paul Walker, directed by Wayne Kramer, and I think he wrote it too. And it was a box office flop. Critically, it was panned by most critics. And Ben Miller, who was on Target Audience podcast, the host of that, he covered it with his late brother based on the recommendation of my own. And he and his late brother, Ben Miller, they covered the movie. And I saw it. Unfortunately, it wasn't really such a good idea to show it to my grandma because she was very horrified. And like, why would you show me this movie, Matt? But I actually think there is a bit more to it than a lot of people would give credit to. It's very intentional that the film is trying to be a modern tale, Grimm's fairy tale kind of movie, with the blue fairy being the hooker and Joey's played by Paul Walker, is the big bad wolf. And this little boy is Pinocchio, who's trying to find a family of his own. And within the movie and all these things, like the Mad Hatter, who's the pimp, dresses in white with like the golden tooth. It's a very bizarre movie and very strange. And it doesn't always work all the time because it does conflict itself with its tones of abrasive violence. And it tries to do the more serious moments where, wait, you just did the most ridiculous moment here with Joey rolling on the ice ring and the bullets don't even hit him once, things like that. And but I really think that film works because of the style. And it's really one of the few times that Paul Walker managed to showcase his acting chops, which is a shame, too, because it's like the one time he's able to do something different and isn't the like pretty boy surfer kid who's in like Fast and Furious or like all these other films, Takers or Into the Blue, and he's actually showing off his range as an actor. And it just never, and it's, he never did anything this crazy or out of the box, so to speak. But I would recommend that, even though it's a very strange movie for sure. And I understand not everyone's going to be on board with it. But the other one is,
I thought he was good in the Hours as well.
Yeah, I forgot about that too. Yeah, he was in that as well. Yeah, God, it just. Yeah. Every time I hear, I even look at his filmography or even think about him, it breaks my heart that he never got a chance to do more acting.
Lazarus Project as well.
Oh, okay. I forgot about that. Okay.
That's different.
But it just sucks too. He never got the chance to show his range or work with more interesting directors. But then again, I think right before he had died, he said he was thinking about laying low for a bit with retiring from acting because he wanted to raise his daughter, and he finally got an opportunity to be in his care. Yeah, it's sad. Anyways, sorry. Because otherwise I'm just gonna go down that whole path. I just said it's like it's gonna take us forever with that whole thing. And then the third one I want to say was, again, another great director I love, Christopher Nolan.
Yeah,
I do not like Interstellar. I know there's like a huge fan base for it.
I've never seen it.
I think it's bad. It's like the worst movie Nolan has done. And look, I get that Tenet isn't, it's not supposed to be it's funny because there's so many memes going around about Tenet being like, it's supposed to be this like groundbreaking cinema, when in reality, like it is gaining a following for sure with Tenet, but even I'm like, look, guys, all it is just Christopher Nolan wanting to do a Bond movie. Yeah. And he does a good enough job with it, even though he does have to deal with a lot of shit that he's used to doing with like heavy expository dialogue. And it doesn't really have an interesting female character like most of his movies, except for Memento, which is like the one movie where it's like he has an interesting, complex female character. And that's it. Even in Oppenheimer, it doesn't even have that at all. But yeah, Interstellar, I absolutely hate. I've seen it twice. And that was another one I tried. I rewatched again. I'm like, all right, it's been like almost 10 years since I've seen it in theaters. Let's see how it turns out. And by the end of it, I was like, it actually got kind of worse for me just because it's the script is very hollow. It's all it's Christopher Nolan trying to be a sort of like Spielberg kind of movie where he's trying to make it a more emotional, captivating kind of movie and make you emotionally care about the characters. But Nolan isn't really the kind of director that does that. Yeah, you emotionally care about The Dark Knight or Oppenheimer, but you're not, he's not doing these trying to be like these sappy emotional bits within the film or schmaltzy bits like Spielberg does, at least how I feel about Nolan as a director. And I've seen all of his movies. And yet I have no idea what Nolan was trying to do with Interstellar. It's a nearly 3-hour movie when you could have told this in two. And it's so bogged with exposition to where I can't get into the emotional bits. And I just don't get it. I really don't. And then everyone's crying in like the middle of the movie. And I'm like, what's to be emotional about? Because I don't know any of these characters. Is this like one of those movies where you have to put where you are in life into the film itself? Because I can get on board with that. That's what the movie is kind of being. But I couldn't do it. And yeah, and no, but I really did not like Interstellar at all. And I'm just glad that. And the other thing, too, is that Interstellar, when that came out, I was like, man, it almost seems like the further away he's gotten from Inception, the worse he's gotten, until Dunkirk came out. And then now we're at Oppenheimer, where it's all right. Those two in particular are the kind of movies I thought you were going to be doing after you did Inception. We just had to wait another 7 to 10 years to do. But yeah, that's my three hot takes for movies.
Yep. Hey, this is Dave Jackson from the School of Podcasting, a show that helps podcasters plan, launch, and grow their podcast. And you're listening to Pods Like Us.
Hey, this is Ross,
Simon,
and Thomas
from Who Takes the Socks Off podcast, the show that answers the questions you didn't even know you needed the answers to.
You're listening to Marv, the one-man podcasting machine,
on Pods Like Us.
We're still waiting for Shyamalan to have a comeback.
Yeah, you're gonna have to wait. You're gonna have to wait forever because I don't think that's ever gonna happen. Yeah. It's like I think for me, I thought, oh, okay, he's back with Split. And then afterwards, I'm like, nope, he got lucky. Yeah.
I've still not seen Split.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good movie. It just, was it Split or? Yeah, I think it was Split. But everything else he's done afterwards has just been really not that great. And yeah, it's just like every director just, yeah, they get kind of lucky. And you also have these like maverick kind of directors that have such a big style that lampoons them into a big movie. Ridley Scott was able to win over a lot of fans of his or old fans of his with The Martian. And then he hasn't really gotten back to that kind of area since The Martian with Napoleon, which sucked, and House of Gucci was boring. Yeah.
Ridley Scott's going to hate me because my two favorite Ridley Scott films would probably be Blade Runner and Alien.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned those two because I actually prefer their sequels more than the originals. I respect what Blade Runner is doing, and I again, certain respect for the original of Alien, but that's just me.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's fine.
Wow. So, crikey, we're already there. So what advice would you give to people if they were starting a show of their own?
I would say my biggest piece of advice I would say when you're doing a show or when you're creating a show is to do your research first. You don't want to be premature with everything. Obviously, you want to make sure that if you're doing a podcast like I'm doing, you want to make sure that you've done all your research. And it, depending on how big or how small your show is, it could take like, a couple of days at most to make, or maybe just a whole month. Cause it took me about half a month to create the show because I had to get the list prepared. I had to get everything down to a T, who's the director, who's the writers for these films. And then I had to find a way to like, how am I going to be able to pay for the editing software? How am I going to do record my system? And also to get a good mic. You really should get a good mic for your show just because yeah, because I've seen a lot of great like shows with a lot of really cool ideas, and they just don't put the necessities to get a good mic. And I got lucky because my folks were willing to give me a new mic, which I'd never requested or asked, but they managed to get one for me for an early birthday gift. But yeah, that's really the two things. Do all your research before you start a show and get a mic, or get a good mic. And as far as like each individual episode itself, get like a glass of water with you on hand that I'm holding right now. And you want to make sure, if you need to, just do some like vocal warm-ups per episode, because I learned that from when I was at high school, where we also had to do like vocal warm-ups right before we did like a play or a musical. Like on the night of, we did like warm-ups. So, but yeah, those have helped.
Yeah, carrying on with the mic thing. If you can, please do not record using the built-in microphone on your laptop.
Yeah, I did that for one or two episodes for the One Inch Barrier podcast, and it's not good. It's not really good audio.
No. It's even worse if you're overworking the laptop, because then you can hear the fan on the laptop kicking in louder than your voice sometimes.
Yeah, which I think you might be able to hear when you go through and edit this episode. But yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
Yep.
Right. So, what sort of podcast do you like to listen to yourself?
I listen to a bunch. Next Best Picture podcast I listen to for awards take, and honestly, to see Josh Parham talking about the lead actress category, which is every year when he's predicting the lead actress, like the last few years have been so chaotic, especially this year with who's going to win, Emma Stone or Lily Gladstone. We'll probably know the answer by the time this episode comes out, but it's so funny to see him predict what's going to win and so on for that category in particular, because he's managed to get Olivia Colman. He actually predicted Olivia Colman to win for The Favorite.
Wow.
Over Olivia Colman. And he also predicted Frances McDormand was going to win for Nomadland as well, which that was also like another chaotic year where it's four of the five lead actress nominees won one major precursor, and the only one to not do it was Vanessa Kirby. But yet everyone else had won like a Golden Globe, Critics' Choice, SAG, BAFTA. And I was like, man, son of a bitch, he managed to get that right. And yeah, it's very interesting. And yeah, there's other podcasts I listen to, Awards Radar. I discovered Awards Radar because Joey Magnuson, a quick side story with that. Yep. He'd actually contacted me directly after he did the first episode with Miles Hughes for Knives Out. And he DM'd me. And I was like, wait a minute, are you Joey? The Joey, the guy that I've been following since Awards Circuit with Karen Peterson, Mark Johnson, Sam Coffey, and Clayton Davis, who's now with The Variety, I believe, at the moment. And yeah, he direct messaged me and said, I want to do an episode with you down the road. And we managed to get an episode for The Big Sick done right before he had to leave for, I think it was like Telluride or TIFF, or maybe it was Venice, I can't remember, but it was one of the big festivals. And I wanted to make sure that he was taken care of, because I know by the time he was getting back, there was no way that he was going to be able to do an episode. And he's also got to do other stuff for his show. So I was like, all right, let's try to record as early as possible. So we did that, and that was fun. But I managed to follow Awards Radar through because of Joey. And if it weren't for Miles' infamous rant on Ghostbusters Afterlife, which was so funny, like the way he described that movie. And I was like, all right, I need to follow this podcast. And I got in touch with Miles, and I even told him a handful of times that episode, that rant in particular, has always been my favorite of his. Whatever he's talking about movies, and the Human Centipede one that Miles did recently was hilarious. But yeah. And another podcast I listen to, Awards Watch. There's a couple other ones. Oscar Wilde is another one I watch, I listen to every so often. I know there's a handful out there that I'm just like, I'm probably forgetting, but it's like the ones I can think of on the top of my head.
I think you would like Let's Party with Marty.
I think I've heard of it. I'll look more into it, though.
They're looking at the films of Martin Scorsese. Do you remember that Martin Scorsese, he started his own Letterboxd account?
Yes, yeah.
And on there, he's mentioning films that he's made and saying these are films not necessarily they weren't all inspiration for the films, but he says that the films that he thinks would work with his own films, essentially. So they're going through the films that Marty's suggested and Marty's own films that Marty's said that they work with. And he is, and they're going through them and working out why Marty suggested these and where the similarities are.
Hmm. Nice. Yeah, I'm looking through it. I actually might listen to a couple of those and probably after the show. I actually did want to mention there's one other podcast I want to give a quick shout out. I don't know if they're still going to be, if they're going to be continuing the show maybe once every year or so now with the Oscars coming in. I listened to the One Inch Barrier podcast.
Yeah.
Hosted by Juan Carlos Ollana. Have you listened to it yet or no?
Not yet. Nope.
Okay. I've been on two episodes. I was on The Salesman and I was on The War and Peace. And it was great to see Juan Carlos Ollana, who's, I believe, from the Philippines, to create that show. Because at one point he had, and even stated this on one of the episodes we were on, he almost thought about pulling the plug on it because of COVID coming in. And I said, no, because everyone's going to be indoors, it's going to be best for you to just go ahead with the show because it's a great idea, covering international films that were submitted or nominated for the Oscars and then covering it almost like Kevin Jacobson does with the And the Runner-Up Is. And it's been wonderful to see that show just flourish and do such a great job with it. But yeah, I'm glad he was able to create that podcast and go through with it.
Okay. So where can people find you and get hold of you, Matt?
Oh boy, hold on. I'm gonna pull up my thing because my link because I didn't even think about doing that before we started. So my link, you could follow me on you could follow me on Twitter or other various social media platforms, or you could follow the podcast in of itself through Linktree at Linktree/Matthew995. Again, that's at Matthew995, all lowercase on Linktree. And you can follow me on Twitter. You can follow my show as well through Twitter. Most, if not all, the episodes should be posted through Spotify. I know there's been a couple of podcasts, like I think Google, and there was another podcast place that said they were going to be shutting down in like March or April, but yeah. I'll be updating them as I go along and making sure those you're not being sent to a link error or whatever. But yeah, just follow me through there, Linktree at Matthew995. And you can also check out some of my work I did at Stevenson University with some of the film projects I did. If you're an Oscar predictor, well, actually, this will be out by April. So you could follow me through, was it by the end of 2024, on what I think we'll probably get in for Oscar nominations or awards considerations. And yeah, that's pretty much it. So yeah.
All right. Thank you for speaking with me today, Matt.
Yeah, sure. Anytime. Thanks for having me on here, Martin. I appreciate it.
It's great. You can find Pods Like Us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Threads. And you can contact us through podslikeus@gmail.com. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening and hope you listen again to another episode of Pods Like Us. Oh,